The GOP convention today focuses on the economy and job creation. Last night, security was the theme, but there was also routine business taken care of. It included approving a party platform that pulls the GOP to the right on several issues. But, as WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks tells us, delegates from Massachusetts believe the right-leaning platform is no real concern.
On the convention floor yesterday, just after party leaders managed to squash an effort by anti-Trump delegates to disrupt the convention, they moved on to the business of passing the new Republican platform.
Is there a second?
Second!
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye!
Opposed? Nay. The ayes have it.
By acclamation, delegates adopted a platform that embraces some of Donald Trump's pet causes, like building a wall along the Mexican border. It also moves hard to the right on a number of social issues that Trump says little about. For example, it calls for overturning marriage equality, condemning same-sex parenting, and restricting transgender rights. In Cleveland this week, it's hard to find delegates who approve of the entire document, but many are comfortable with a lot of it.
Very much so. For example, I was very glad that part of the party platform was the endorsement of the wall with Mexico, the border security wall.
Tom Mountain is an alternate Trump delegate and the chairman of the local Republican Party of Newton. He doesn't like the part of the platform that would restrict LGBT rights, and he says it doesn't reflect Donald Trump's campaign.
What the platform says pertaining to all the gay Republicans and what Mr. Trump believes is two totally different things. Mr. Trump has always been for gay rights.
What's striking about the new platform is how it seems to ignore the so-called Republican autopsy following the 2012 election. Among other things, the autopsy recommended opening the party up to make it more inclusive. Keiko Orrell is a Massachusetts state rep, a Trump supporter, and an incoming RNC committee woman.
That's the type of Republican Party that I want to be a part of, a party that's including people, all kinds and all colors of people, because I want to grow and unify our party and help us get to a place where our message is getting out to all kinds of people.
Orrell says this platform, with its tough line on LGBT rights, risks taking the GOP in the opposite direction. Governor Mary Fallon of Oklahoma is co-chair of the platform committee. She told CNN that denying LGBT rights means not giving special rights to a particular class of people.
What we talked about is how can we make America great, and how can we believe and stand for the human rights of all people? Not just one segment, one class, one race.
But despite the debate and controversy about the platform, Peter Farrell says it just doesn't matter. Farrell is another alternate delegate from Massachusetts who supports Marco Rubio.
My experience is that party platforms don't have a lot of consequence, and they're often the subject of intense debate. At the end of the day, it's the occupant of the White House that will drive the agenda, regardless of what the platform planks say.
And history is full of examples of that, according to Roger Stone, a former advisor and longtime friend to Donald Trump.
The 1972 Republican platform said that President Richard Nixon would never go to China, nor would we ever recognize them. The 1968 Republican convention said that we would adhere strictly to the gold standard and hard money. Platforms are anachronism. They're largely meaningless.
So why do we do them?
Tradition.
Stone says platforms also please the base of the party, but he says just about everyone recognizes that they're not worth the fight because they're not binding. But Delegate Tom Mountain, who we heard from earlier, says platforms are worth the fight because they send a message about the party, and he's worried about the message this platform sends to gays and lesbians.
It would be akin to making an anti-Israel platform and trying to get more Jews in. We need to get these people in, not because we need to get them in also, but because it's the right thing to do. Otherwise, they're just going to go to Hillary.
Mountain says just when the GOP should be expanding its tent, this platform is telling the LGBT community to stay out. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
The Republican National Convention has begun with some disunity and a little more drama than is usual at a modern-day convention.
Point of order!
That is obviously a loud and somewhat chaotic scene yesterday as opponents of Donald Trump tried unsuccessfully to force a roll call vote on convention rules in hopes of freeing up delegates from their commitments to Trump. But it was just a brief moment, quickly put down by Trump supporters. In comparison, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin of Concord points out what a truly split convention the GOP experienced back in 1912. Incumbent President William Howard Taft was challenged by populist Teddy Roosevelt, who had popular support, while Taft was backed by the party establishment.
It became such a raucous campaign with Teddy and Taft yelling at each other, calling each other pinheads and jugheads and dictators, that the New York Times wrote an editorial saying, if this is the first system in which we're using primaries to choose our nominees, we sincerely hope it is the last. This must bring a blush to foreigners to watch what we are doing. This is not a rational system. This is a mob.
I want to go back to 1912 in the current context. The GOP party right now, as we know, is split in disarray over the Trump candidacy. A lot of high-profile Republicans have just walked away from it. Was 1912 like that?
Yes. I mean, I think the whole situation we're facing today with the GOP establishment feeling a great division from the Trump candidate was started in 1912, because that's when the primary system really evolved. Up until that point, party leaders would choose the nominee, so the establishment would have a huge control over who it would be, and they would try to choose somebody who could bring consensus within the different factions of the party. And in 1912, Taft, as the sitting president, had control of the party machinery. So when Teddy Roosevelt decided to challenge his old friend within the Republican Party, William Howard Taft, he knew the only way he could win the convention delegates would be to institute a set of primaries in states where the people themselves could choose the nominee.
There are some of the GOP, people who are opposed to Donald Trump within the GOP, who say the Trump campaign is a first in American history. Is that actually true? Is it wholly unique?
I think the political mix that has produced the Trump campaign certainly has echoes in American history. I mean, most notably at the turn of the 20th century, you had a very potent mix of populist feeling brought about by the change from the agricultural world that most people lived in to the Industrial Revolution, people feeling a great sense of too much accelerating change, lots of immigration, a great gap having grown between the rich and the poor. Then when you think about the present now, you've got concerns about immigration, you've got a technological revolution, you've got accelerating change, people feeling like the old moorings have fallen apart.
Is Donald Trump running a populist campaign from your point of view?
I think he's certainly trying to mobilize the anxieties and the sentiments and perhaps the fears of the people at large, and providing more sort of simple answers to what they're feeling, which is what populism often did. You know, it recognized that there were groups of people out there who were feeling anxious, lots of sense that the country isn't what it used to be. And populists sometimes can provide simple answers, shortcut answers. I'll make America great again.
Is he good at it compared to populist campaigns of the past?
Well, if you compare Trump to Williams Jennings Bryan, even though Bryan had some simplistic answers to the problem, like the silver standard replacing the gold standard, nonetheless, he also had a series of very important programs that became part of the Democratic Party eventually and became part of the progressive movement that had to do with wages and hours, conditions in factories, taxation, etc. So he came more fully loaded, I think, with a series of substantive programs in addition to the simple solutions.
Temperament is at issue now in terms of Donald Trump's behavior out on the campaign trail, and it was then as well.
I think temperament is probably one of the most important things we should always be looking for in a leader. They said about Franklin Roosevelt, when Oliver Wendell Holmes, 92 years old, met him for the first time right after Roosevelt was elected president, and he was asked, well, what did you think of him? And he said, well, I think he has a second-rate intellect, but a first-rate temperament. I think he had a first-rate intellect as well. But temperament is the great separator for, when I look at the presidents I've studied, what does it mean? It means your basic disposition toward life. how you get through adversity, how you acknowledge errors when you've made one, how you control negative emotions, how you have empathy or not. This is the basic fundamentals of a character, and I think it shows up in temperament.
I'm wondering how crucial you think it is for Trump to come out of the convention with Republicans saying positive things about him, if that's possible.
To have a convention that doesn't produce a Republican somewhat unity, I think will be very hard for him. Plus, there's always the possibility of what it might look like, the convention. I mean, we obviously saw in 1912 when the delegations from Taft and Teddy were actually throwing things at each other in the hotel lobbies, when there were gunfights, when there were 3,000 policemen surrounding the convention, that the whole site, or it wasn't seen by television then, but the reports of that convention hurt both candidates, and the Democrat won.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, thanks very much for speaking to WBUR's Morning Edition.
I'm glad I could be here with you. Thank you.
Turkish military leaders say all of those responsible for last weekend's attempted coup have now been neutralized. The United Nations says it's concerned that people involved in the coup might not get a fair trial. There are many Americans still in Turkey who are trying to get home, including Gonca Sunmezpul of Somerville, who was visiting family there. She's now in Istanbul, but was in the southern part of Turkey when the coup began. We spoke with her just a little while ago this morning and asked her whether she realized a coup was underway last Friday.
I had absolutely no idea. I mean, Turkey has been a confusing place for a long time. But the idea of thinking of a coup, it's not something that comes to you naturally. What happened is we were in the south, you know, with my husband, and that night we happened to go to bed fairly early, and my phone is always next to me. I sat up in bed like about 2:30 a.m., and there was a news alert from New York Times. What followed were like lots of messages from my friends in the U.S. asking me how I was. That's how I was woken up and figured out something was going on.
So let me ask you this. How tense is the mood right now on the streets of Turkey in Istanbul, where you are?
Well, it depends on where you are somewhat. I am right now in a fairly, I would say, you know, stable, not like the real center, you know, the center part of Istanbul. There are areas that are a lot more crowded. And last night, like there's a major square, Taksim Square, where there was tons and tons of people still just sort of out there on the street. Basically, the way that's reported is that they're out there because they came against the coup during, you know, when it was happening and after, encouraged by the government, and they were out there in Taksim Square just sort of protesting in a peaceful way. I can't say that there is any kind of outright violence, but people are tense because they're confused and they don't know what the future is really holding.
So is it uncomfortable to be there for you? Is it uncomfortable to be an American in Turkey at this time?
That's a hard question, Bob. I've been, you know, because of my profession and because of what I've been thinking about the last decade, and having aging parents here, I feel like I come and go, and you know, the rest is sort of up to God and fate or whatever. I have to come and go. I can't think that I'm in danger. However, when the news of the coup came, of course, the first thing I heard from actually our children back in the United States was that, you know, you have to register your name with the consulate because after all, what if something happens? And it is uncomfortable.
As I understand it, you had planned to stay in Turkey until next month. Is that still the plan? The airports, as we read, are open, but do you at all feel stuck there?
Until actually late last night, I felt a little bit of a feeling of a stuckness because it was very clear that the FAA stopped flights. FAA had basically blacklisted Turkish Airlines, which flies a lot of direct flights between Istanbul and U.S. They had stopped that. And I was a little worried. We were, you know, looking into and thinking about how else we were going to get back because our tickets were at the for the beginning of August. Late last night, the news came that FAA and Turkish Airlines did come to an agreement. So we feel okay, but we're in a very unsettled situation in Turkey. So I'm hoping nothing else will happen between now and when I have my ticket back.
Well, good luck to you. Please stay safe, you and your parents, and we appreciate your speaking to Morning Edition today. Gonca Sanmez-Poole from Somerville.
Thank you.